Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for November the 25th, 2018, as we close out the Thanksgiving holiday weekend and move full steam ahead into Christmas time. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way over to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And it's a, you know, Dave, I was kind of thinking it was like the calm before the storm with all of the weather forecasts that we're hearing about winter storm warning. But it's actually very nice out there right now.
It is the calm before the storm. Yes. It may sound like a cliche, but it's true. What with things moving in, and again, looking at the radar, Western Illinois starting to be affected by this. It has been moving indefinitely into our direction. Matt was also talking about Northwest Indiana and Michigan, which will be affected by this also. Less so than areas north of the city and certainly west of the city, where snow amounts could be 12, maybe 15 inches in spots. So, you know, here we are.
Here we are is right.
And you know, calendar-wise, winter doesn't start until something like December 21st. So this is giving us
When has the calendar ever mattered in this city?
It doesn't.
You know?
It doesn't.
I mean, think about it. but it is that time of year, right? But it was gorgeous yesterday.
Windy, but warm, though. Yeah, it felt almost spring-like. Hate to say that, but, you know, that's what it was like out there.
Well, and Matt mentioned that, you know, with the fact that we don't have the Bears playing today, Blackhawks playing last night, I had to wear my Cubs throwback kind of outfit today, kind of wishing for spring to get here.
96 days, by the way. I just looked it up.
I was just going to say, Andy, when does spring training start? 96
yeah.
days?
Well, 96 little... days till March 1st.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's...
So even less than until spring
little
training.
A little over 3 months.
Yep. Well, it's not that long.
No.
Okay, it's not
it
that
It only seems that long.
Yes, and it will seem even longer tomorrow.
I start counting the hours toward the end of January.
Well, I hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving.
Yes, we did.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And so did I. And I'm going to try to recreate some Thanksgiving today and make a bird, leftover bird, and do some of the trimmings, and I, of course, thought about grilling it, but I guess today is probably not a great day to be hanging out at the grill.
Stay inside and fire up that oven.
Or the fireplace.
Or the fireplace. That, too.
Oh, man. Well, did you have any leftovers left? Or?
Well, we continued a tradition of going out to eat, although we went to a new place for the first time this year, since my dad is a little further away from the city now. It'll be tough for him to get on the South Shore and get in, so we tried a place that's rather local to him, and it was fine. No leftovers. We ate everything there. We cleaned our plates more than once.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, buffet style.
It was very good. It was very good.
Whoa,
from start to finish.
That sounds great. And, of course, there was the Bears' victory on Thanksgiving Day,
yeah,
which
we
was
were, we
nice.
Were paying attention to that as we were eating. So was everybody else in the dining room, I might add.
I don't know. With the Bears, it's still difficult for me to eat and watch the Bears sometimes. But, a win's a win.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, too. You think of three division opponent victories in 12 days.
Yeah, and I mentioned to the folks the other day when I was working in the morning that the three wins in 12 days against division teams equals the amount of wins John Fox had in 3 years against the division.
Wow.
He won three games in 3 years.
Amazing. Just amazing. Well, what I love is there is a reason to want to watch the Bears now, where before they were almost optional. It was like background noise.
Yeah, they were starting to become irrelevant.
Yeah, and not in this town.
And it should never be that way.
But no, now there's reason, and I mean they're a virtual shoe-in. I gotta say, who do we root for tonight with
Mother
Minnesota
Nature.
Against Green Bay?
Mother Nature.
Mother Nature?
Yeah.
Can't we root for a tie again?
Yeah, a tie would be great.
It'd be perfect, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think it might have to be Green Bay.
I was thinking that too, is that given the standings,
yeah,
we probably do have to root
for Green
Bay. I
think it might have to be Green Bay.
Well, in that way, but wouldn't that give Green Bay some kind of an edge?
Well, because they beat the Bears once already.
Right.
Minnesota 5-4-1, Green Bay 4-5-1, and the Bears at 8-3. So it's basically two and a half right now.
Right. And that half will kind of stay there with that tie.
Yeah, with a tie.
So
yeah, another tie would be great.
That's exactly what I was
thinking. But if Green Bay wins, they're both 5-5-1, and they're still basically two and a half games behind.
Who do we have next?
Next is at the Giants coming up next Sunday, week from today.
Ah, okay.
And then home for the Rams on Sunday night.
That'll be a big game.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a very
That's
big
a
game.
Week from tonight.
Yeah, the Giants game is a week from tonight.
Okay. Right.
Or a week from today. And then the 2 weeks from today will be the Rams here in town for the night game.
Okay. Cool.
And maybe the snow will be cleared off Soldier Field.
Yeah, hopefully. It'll be a couple of days closer to spring.
Well, yeah, there you go. That's how we'll start the show from now on, is how many days till spring.
I guess we're in meteorological winter because that, the meteorologically speaking, it's the season start before we recognize them on the calendar. So maybe the storm is right on schedule here for the start of meteorological winter. We'll have to ask Mike Hammernick about that later.
Well, right on time is a bad term. I mean, there's never a good time for a storm.
No. Nope.
And when you think about...
Well, the timing couldn't be worse with this being the travel day today.
Exactly. Mm. That's exactly what I was thinking, is just everybody on the road or
trying
scrambling
to fly
at the airports.
Yeah.
And already flight cancellations at O'Hare. And
up to 153.
And it was just 138
yeah.
a few minutes ago.
And six at Midway. But, yes, there will be delays.
There will be delays. Did you get any Black Friday shopping done?
I didn't actually do any.
You didn't?
I know. It was a very long day for me work-wise on Friday, so I didn't. But I have planned out what I'm going to get certain people already.
Excellent.
So it's a matter of going online, and I know what I want and where to find it, and also going to real stores. When it comes to Christmas, I'm old-fashioned. And, the more I can go to a real store and look at the merchandise and buy things and, get real cards, the happier I am with that. But I know what I want. I know what I'm going to do already.
Well, I mean, it's Cyber Monday coming up.
Right. So I'll be tomorrow. I probably
if you get snowed in that'd be yeah. There's your perfect chance.
I'll be one of the numbers that you hear about, however many online shoppers there will be. I'll be one of those tomorrow,
buying a kind of one of those voice assistants.
Well, I just recently got rid of the dial-up modem on my computer at home.
And the rotary dial phones.
And the rotary dial phone. I have a touch tone princess phone now that lights
nice.
Up at night.
Oh, how cute. That's very sweet.
So
with the lighted buttons?
I'm moving in. I'm in 1971 right
cool.
now.
Cool. Wow. Congratulations. Welcome
right.
to it.
How's that phonograph?
How's the 8-track working?
Yeah.
Oh, I can plug it in now. I don't have to wind it up.
Uh-huh.
My brother had a quadraphonic 8-track player, which, it was great when you'd have...
It was a quad 8-track player?
Yes, quadraphonic sound, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and it was great. You'd get some song rocking, we're just a band out of Boston, and it's going.
Oh. The Edgar Winter Group playing Frankenstein.
Yes.
Quadraphonic.
Yes. And then it would just be rocking, and then it'd be fade down, and then
Could you come back up after it had to change the tracks?
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Great moves there. But we've come so far, haven't we?
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. In fact,
kids don't know what they're missing.
Well, our good friend Eric Elk, a good buddy of the show, he just texted me that he's listening on the WGN app right
there you
now
go.
From Brussels, Belgium.
Wow.
Well, that was the center of news activity.
I was just going to say, Brexit. Yeah. Leave it to Eric to be right there in the middle of Brexit talks with the EU. Now that the EU has approved Theresa May's British plan to exit the European Union. So a busy news day in the front over in Brussels and as well as in Great Britain with lots of unanswered questions there.
Yeah, she has her work kind of cut out for her to sell this to the Parliament now.
Yes, and there seems to be a lot of second guessing going on over there. So, yeah. Interesting times. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Kassira is in and fielding your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is still trying to recover from all the Black Friday shopping that he did. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin, 7:21 on this Sunday morning. Please travel safely, as we'll have all the latest weather updates throughout the day, overnight, and into tomorrow morning. Time to launch our weekly spin through national politics. And before President Trump left for Thanksgiving at his Florida resort, the Southern White House, as he calls it, Trump made clear that despite the best intelligence estimates about complicity in the death of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi's murder by order of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, despite that, the U.S. would not crack down on Saudi Arabia. For Trump, he says it was a simple equation to basically trade a journalist's death for America's economic well-being.
Because it's America first for me. It's all about America first. We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders and let Russia, China, and everybody else have them. It's all about, for me, very simple. It's America first. Saudi Arabia, if we broke with them, I think your oil prices would go through the roof. I've kept them down. They've helped me keep them down. Right now we have low oil prices, or relatively. I'd like to see it go down even lower. But I think that it's a very simple equation for me. I'm about make America great again, and I'm about America first.
Now, Saudi Arabia, it might be pointed out, is actually trying to limit oil production in order to force an increase in gasoline prices, despite what the president said. Though the CIA said the Crown Prince ordered Khashoggi's murder with its best intelligence available that occurred at the Saudi embassy in Turkey. Despite that, Trump disputes the findings of his intelligence community in Washington.
Maybe he did. Maybe he did. They did not make that assessment. The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. If you look at Iran, what they've done, they've been a bad actor. You look at what's happening in Syria with Assad, with hundreds of thousands of people killed. We are with Saudi Arabia. We're staying with Saudi Arabia.
Now, the president said he had no personal financial interest in Saudi Arabia. He went on to say that being president has cost him a fortune.
Just so you understand, I don't make deals with Saudi Arabia. I don't have money from Saudi Arabia. I have nothing to do with Saudi Arabia. I couldn't care less. And I will tell you, and as most of you know, being president has cost me a fortune, and that's okay with me. I knew that a long time ago. But being president has cost me a fortune. A tremendous fortune like you've never seen before. But someday I'll tell you what that is. And I knew that a long time ago, because I don't do deals. All I do is focus on this country and making great deals for this country. I don't focus on making great deals for myself, because I don't care anymore. So Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with me. What does have to do with me is putting America first.
Now, even though he says that being president has cost him a great fortune, the Washington Post reported that Trump properties made more than $4.2 million from Republican campaigns during the recent midterm elections. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former CIA director, was asked about why the U.S. was maintaining full relations with the Saudis and what the intelligence community suggests is a murderous regime. Here's Pompeo's answer.
It's a mean, nasty world out there. The Middle East in particular. There are important American interests to keep the American people safe, to protect Americans, not only Americans who are here, but Americans who are traveling and working, doing business in the Middle East. It is the president's obligation, indeed the State Department's duty as well, to ensure that we adopt policies that further the America's national security. So as the president said today, the United States will continue to have a relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They're an important partner of ours. We will do that with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, its people. That is the commitment that the president made today.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Also last week, as the president was in Florida, he decided to criticize the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and basically blame rulings involving issues such as migrant asylum policy on an, quote, Obama judge. Chief Justice John Roberts of the U.S. Supreme Court pushed back and said in his own statement, to the Associated Press, that the U.S. doesn't have Obama judges or Trump judges or Bush judges or Clinton judges, and that an independent judiciary is something that we should all be thankful for during the Thanksgiving time. That's actually kind of the first time that we've heard the Chief Justice of the United States respond to Trump's criticism of judges, something that the president does frequently. You know, this is kind of what he uses when there are rulings against him. He blames it on the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals overturning things such as his asylum ban. He was asked about that before he left, as well as about having the U.S. military on the nation's border at Thanksgiving time and whether he had any thoughts about that. Here's what the president had to say.
Oh, you don't worry about the Thanksgiving. These are tough people. They know what they're doing and they're great and they've done a great job. You're so worried about the Thanksgiving holiday for them. They are so proud to be representing our country on the border, where if you look at what's happening, Mexico, the people from Tijuana are saying, wow, these are tough people. They're fighting us.
There were also reports, too, that Mexico had agreed on an arrangement in which it would let asylum seekers stay in Mexico, people seeking asylum in the United States, but that they would be kept in Mexico. But later, the president of Mexico refuted the statement from his own foreign affairs secretary. So that's still up in the air as well. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone right now is Republican State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield. Representative, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Absolutely. Happy to be on, Rick. Andy, watch live video so I can see that you're fully regaled in Cubs gear today, so that's good.
It's wishful thinking. You know, it's like spring ahead.
How many days till spring, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We've got the countdown clock going here. And
that's good.
Well, I mean, I could have worn my Hawks regalia for celebrating last night's victory.
I was glad to see they pulled it out last night. They needed a win like that.
The only time they led was when they won it in overtime, which is
absolutely
a fantastic thing. But, well, Representative, thanks again for joining me this morning. And I wanted to have you on after I had a conversation in last week's show with the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum Foundation. And I know that they've appeared before lawmakers in Springfield as they're trying to obtain a $9.2 million taxpayer payment from the state to pay for a loan that involves Lincoln-related memorabilia items, some of which are of questionable provenance. And I know you were listening to the show, and I kind of wanted you to give your impression kind of from the legislative point of view about the justification for that loan. It was kind of interesting that morning, the State Journal Register, this newspaper in Springfield, had basically said that the foundation had failed to make its case.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's really come out here in the last several months is that as the foundation has looked to pay off this debt, and this is a debt that they incurred, a private foundation incurred, you know, over a decade ago, and on a $23 million loan, and they've got another, you know, 9.2 to pay off on it, as you said. You know, they've come to the state because I think they've kind of run into a wall on fundraising on this. And I think all of us want to see the museum, certainly the state side, the official side, to succeed and be a wonderful institution that it is. But when the private foundation comes to the state for such a large chunk of change, I think you are going to have some questions raised. And this is really what has happened over the last few months. You know, originally this kind of became public a few months ago in the spring when the foundation announced they might have to auction off some of the Lincoln items to pay for the debt. And after that is when I had my first discussions with the folks from the foundation about moving forward possibly some state funding. And then as it went on, it came out not too long ago, just I think over a month, month and a half ago, additional stories about the history, especially of the Lincoln hat and whether or not that can be proven that Lincoln had the hat. And so that kind of led to the hearing that we had in Springfield a couple weeks ago during the first week of veto session. And, you know, my hope is we can move forward in a positive manner to try to get this resolved. But I still think there's really significant questions out there about the foundation, about what the path forward is in paying down this debt. And I think at a time when we are continue to have budget challenges in Illinois, to the idea that we're going to have $9.2 million go to this private foundation for a debt that they incurred is a pretty tall ask right now for the state.
Well, and their explanation was that they're like other institutions that are their governmental institutions. I think they were citing like universities where there are also, you know, charitable foundations that are also part of it, and so that they don't consider it an ask any different than in that vein.
Well, I think that's, you know, when you look at the museum in total, taxpayers spent over $150 million building the facility. The annual budget for the museum right now is about $11 million, which I would like to see increased if we could. But, you know, this idea that you know, the state should join with the foundation, which I think we should, but doing it after the fact, I think it was mentioned something about how, you know, building projects at universities are done in collaboration with foundations and the state and so on, which I agree is what happens, but it doesn't happen, you know, a decade after the fact in a way. And so, you know, I've gone back and looked at the initial reports when the foundation purchased the collection, when this foundation got up and going, and, you know, it really wasn't, you know, the deal wasn't made at the time that the state was going to be on the hook for obtaining this collection. It certainly was purchased by the foundation for a public purpose, but at no time up until recently was the idea that the foundation would partner with the state to pay down this debt, as opposed to something that might happen when, you know, a university building is built from the beginning. So I think that's, you know, one of the frustrations as well, is that, you know, it's kind of changed over time, you know, why this was purchased and who's going to pay for this collection. Again, I think this, you know, there's significant items in this collection. I think we'd all want to see them remain with the state. But at the end of the day, you know, we have an oversight responsibility in the General Assembly. We have to be good stewards of the people's dollars. And when there's all these questions out there, like I said, I think it's a pretty tall ask right now to say to have the state come in with funding for it.
Well, have they shown you any view of a path forward from the foundation?
I really haven't. And I've asked, you know, several times for what the fundraising plan is. And the foundation has said that there are potential donors out there, especially donors if the state would come in and assist. And I'm not completely saying no to state money, but I think what we need to do is we need to work collaboratively, which I really have not seen over the last few months. We need to work collaboratively to figure this out. And, you know, the foundation, when we had the hearing in Springfield, the foundation handed out materials that showed they were asking for $5 million in state funding. And then at the hearing, you know, it was said that the foundation's looking for the $9.2 million. So, you know, the foundation doesn't even know exactly what they want right now. And so I think, you know, we need to see a solid plan from the foundation as to how they're going to raise this money and then kind of move forward from there to see how we can resolve the situation.
Well, I can't really put myself in their shoes, but I just have to wonder how hard is it to try to raise money off of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, you know, the foundation says it's hard to pay off debt. Well, this has been debt from day one, since when it was purchased. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, this is Abraham Lincoln. This is, you know, we are the land of Lincoln. He's our favorite son and, you know, in a lot of our estimation, the greatest president that we've had in the United States. The museum is a wonderful facility in our state's capital to showcase Abraham Lincoln. I would think that there are, you know, folks that could certainly help us underwrite this debt and get it paid off and really, beyond that, chart a path forward how we become sustainable from the foundation side so we can support what the money that we're spending on the state side as well.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River and the beautiful Lake Michigan, the calm before the storm. Joining me on the phone is State Representative Tim Butler, Republican of Springfield. We're talking about some of the financial issues surrounding the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum Foundation. And what's the next step here, Tim, as far as what has to happen? I know there's a push to try to get a state audit of the foundation. The CEO said that, you know, they'll comply as any other foundation would comply with whatever rules are set. But it sounded less than a solid trade of that for the $9.2 million commitment.
Yeah, you know, a couple things. We, as you mentioned, Senator Jason Barrickman of Bloomington and myself have introduced audit resolutions in both the Senate and the House. It only takes the action of one chamber to move forward and ask the Auditor General to audit whatever's spelled out in the resolution. So the Auditor General believes that because of some of the financial relationships between the foundation and the museum, and again, you know, the foundation's a private entity, the museum's a state facility, but they do have relationships through the gift shop and a restaurant and some other actions where we believe that the Auditor General can go in and do an audit of at least some of the finances and some of the actions that have been taken. And I think that's a good first step, to shed a little more light on, you know, the activities and what has happened. But I think moving forward, like I said earlier, I think there has to be this collaborative idea that both the foundation and the museum and those of us in the legislature can work together to figure out a path forward. I think for me, I'd like to have a serious discussion with the foundation about what their strategy is around fundraising. And I have yet to really see that or hear that. And I think that's the key. If we know that the foundation, you know, is serious about raising the money that's needed and moving forward, then maybe we can look at, you know, some sort of, you know, path forward with some state funding. But I think until we get to that point, it's going to be hard. Again, and also I think there needs to be a renewal of the relationship between the foundation and the museum. I asked that question to both the CEO of the foundation and the director of the museum at the hearing, and about what their relationship is on a day-to-day basis. And it seems to me that relationship is strained, and we cannot have these two entities working at cross purposes. They got to work hand in glove to better the museum and move us forward in a good manner.
I want to shift topics here just a minute, because I know that you're also the co-chair of the Illinois Bicentennial. We have the birthday celebration that's up ahead here for the state of Illinois. And, I mean, you've been co-chairing this. I have to wonder if people are giving enough attention to, you know, what an occasion this really is.
Well, it's certainly, you know, Rick, it's been a difficult time, I would say, for the state over the last few years, and certainly with the commission that's been up and going now for almost a couple of years. You know, there hasn't been a lot of state dollars behind this, other than a few staff that have helped us plan for it. We have been able to raise money to do some programs, and we've done some good things. I think some lasting things for the state of Illinois. But when you look back, certainly at the sesquicentennial, the 150th, 50 years ago, or the 100th anniversary, 100 years ago, it seems to me that there was, you know, more celebration around those activities. I will say, and this is, I do think this is one area where, you know, the Chicago metropolitan area, maybe the rest of the state, are a little different. It seems to me downstate that there's been more activities and more awareness of the fact that it's the bicentennial year, but at the end of the day, December 3rd is going to be our 200th anniversary of the state. It's a pretty historic day, and we're going to look forward to a good celebration at Navy Pier, in the ballroom at Navy Pier, to help celebrate that. So hopefully it'll be a good day. And you know, it's certainly in Illinois we have our challenges, but I think this is a good opportunity for the people of our state to say why they're proud to be Illinoisans.
Maybe it's a kind of a generational thing. You know,
well, I think that could certainly be part of it. You know, again, I mean, Illinois has had our challenges politically and you know, from a variety of sources, and we know the struggles over the past few years, and I think sometimes it takes some self-evaluation of all of us to take a look at our state and realize that this is a great state. And I think it's incumbent upon some of us as leaders to help tell that story as well. You know, Illinois is a very, very diverse state. It's a diverse state with its people. It's a diverse state throughout its geography. And it's long has been a leader in the nation on a variety of fronts. And so, you know, my hope is this does give people pause to, you know, take a look at and evaluate who we are as Illinoisans, and hopefully be proud to do that. But certainly also, you know, talk about how we can change the future to get back Illinois to, you know, a state that's growing and being a true leader in the country.
Take the long view, not just the short view of things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look back at the history of the state, obviously, you know, we were founded as a state that was kind of on the frontier, and people moved to Illinois for economic opportunity. My mother's side of my family goes back to the very foundings of the state. We've been here all 200 years, and you know, my relatives back then moved here for economic opportunity. I think that's one of the key drivers. I mean, we need to make sure people want to move to Illinois because we have a strong, robust economy. And that's one of the things that's going to help us move forward. If we can get this figured out on the economic side, and not just in one region of the state, but across the state, you know, that's going to help us, you know, lay a future that's positive for Illinois.
I also want to ask you, too, about the resumption of the veto session this week. And just whether, what is the climate down there like? I mean, obviously, we're in a situation where we have a governor who is leaving. We'll be getting a new governor on the 14th of January. And I guess I'm just curious, from the Republican side of the aisle, if there's kind of a feeling of being able to be, perhaps, for lack of a better term, a free agent in looking at these vetoes.
Well, certainly, I mean, we saw the first week of veto session where several of the bills that Governor Rauner had vetoed were overridden. Many of those were passed with larger margins than what was needed to override a veto in the first place. And I think some of the more contentious issues we're probably not going to see on an override of the veto. I think the Democrats will wait until the spring session and when we come back in January to maybe act on some things where they didn't get the 71 vote threshold in the House to override a veto. But certainly, you know, for those of us on the Republican side, it's a transitional period to say the least. You know, election night was not a good night for the Republican Party in Illinois. And I think we need to do some evaluation on how we move forward. And, you know, certainly it's going to be a different attitude in Springfield when, you know, we don't have someone sitting in the governor's mansion of our party. And we've lost seats in the General Assembly. And it's going to take a new way of doing business. And like I have always said, you know, I try to operate in a pretty good bipartisan fashion. This is why you make relationships on both sides of the aisle, so you can try to impact change on legislation no matter what the situation is.
Well, do you accept when incoming Governor J.B. Pritzker says that he wants to, you know, have Republicans at the table and talking about policy? I mean, do you accept that on good faith?
Well, I think I've only met the governor-elect once or twice for a handshake. I take him at his word for now. And, you know, obviously when people get elected, there's a lot of talk after the election about bipartisanship and working together. And my hope is that's going to be a theme that will run throughout the Pritzker administration. And, you know, we'll see off the bat. I think he has an opportunity to reach out to Republicans. We've got a lot of good people on our side of the aisle. And as I've noted, you know, 46% of the state did not vote for Mr. Pritzker. So there's a lot of people, especially downstate and other areas that, you know, are looking for a path forward that is bipartisan. So, you know, I look forward to working with him. It's going to be certainly a new atmosphere in Springfield, and I'll remain hopeful, I guess, until I see anything different.
Well, and obviously downstate, part of that diversity that you were talking about, you know, what makes Illinois a unique laboratory, I think, and one that has always been part of its success, but also that diversity now seems to be part of the division that we see both politically and on issues. And instead of focusing on the divisions, to try to find where the common ground exists.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And you know, it's difficult in the current environment that seems to be supercharged on so many issues, whether it's the conservative-liberal divide, whether it's a racial divide or things like this. And I think that's incumbent upon those of us in elected positions to, you know, to dial back the rhetoric a little bit, figure out how to work together. And at the end of the day, you know, most people, I believe, in this country fall somewhere between the two extremes. I mean, we're not nearly as conservative nor nearly as liberal as a lot of elected officials think we are in this country. And I think that people want us to find good, solid, bipartisan, common sense solutions in the middle. And so hopefully my colleagues in the House and the Senate will keep that in mind as we craft legislation moving forward. But certainly for those of us on the Republican side, you know, it's going to be difficult in the beginning trying to figure out how to navigate this and have an impact on legislation in the spring session when we're back in the super minority again.
That's Republican State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Absolutely, Rick. Hope your listeners take care with all the snow coming.
And you as well. I see it's coming to Central Illinois as well. So take care.
Only an inch or two in Springfield, I think.
Very good. Thanks again.
Thanks, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. This is the second hour of the Sunday Spin. Last week, the president announced that he had finished answering written questions to special counsel Robert Mueller, and later his lawyers said they had submitted the answers to the special counsel.
The written answers are finished? I don't know. The lawyers have them. I don't know. They will. They will. The written answers to the witch hunt that's been going on forever. No collusion, no nothing. They've been finished. Finished them yesterday. The lawyers have them. I assume they'll turn them in today or soon.
So we'll be staying tuned to see what those written answers produce as far as Robert Mueller's investigation. President also said the economy was doing well despite a market drop. And more than that, he warned of the possibility of even more tariffs on China.
As a country, we're doing great. Our unemployment is at a record low. You look at all of the different statistics. I think your tech stocks have some problems, but that'll come back. But no, I think we're going to do very well. I'd like to see the Fed with a lower interest rate. I think the rate's too high. I think we have much more of a Fed problem than we have a problem with anyone else. We're doing very well with China. China wants to make a deal very badly. They might not say that to you, but they want to make it very badly. I have another $250 billion worth of tariffs to put on if we don't make a deal. And believe me, I'll be putting them on because China's been ripping off our country for many, many years. And they don't rip us off with me.
That's the President of the United States. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Democratic State Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch, Democrat from Hillside. Representative, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick. Good morning, and nice outfit. We almost were twins.
Well, I've got my Cubs wear, but you have the purple of Northwestern and a big victory against the Fighting Illini yesterday.
Absolutely.
Big a little closer than I think it should have been.
They just wanted to make the rest of the state feel, you know.
Oh, that was a unity move. Yeah, right. Yeah. But
it's a big week ahead, though.
Absolutely.
Ohio State is the real deal.
Well, they kind of had an exclamation point on their game against Michigan yesterday.
But they're going to be upset on Saturday.
You mean personally upset? You mean there's going to be an upset?
There's going to be a big upset. I'm calling it right now.
Okay.
You heard it here first.
Final score?
Northwestern wins.
What's the score?
24-23.
All right. You heard it here first. And we've got this now on tape, by the way, so we'll play it back next Sunday to see how accurate you were. I wanted to have the representative on the show because, and this stems from something from a couple of weeks ago when the Illinois Association of School Boards was holding its annual meetings here in Chicago, and there was a move by some members of the association get a resolution approved that would allow the arming of school teachers and other school personnel as their method of trying to keep students safe. And it lost the resolution by about 30 votes, but still that seemed to be a pretty close vote. But I was even more surprised that this has been an ongoing effort by some largely downstate school board members proposing this, and this was the third year in a row where this resolution had come up.
Yeah, you know, the vote was way too close for comfort. This is a vote we're talking about on Illinois Association of School Board resolution number 2 at about this time last week, and it is the third year in a row that this resolution has been voted on, and I think it was too close for comfort because, you know, they're kind of they've been quietly doing this kind of under the cover of darkness. And you know, we came out last week and we shined a light on this thing. We wanted to make sure people knew what was going on and that school board members were aware that we were watching and paying close attention to this. This is an issue that's really been being pushed at the national level by Donald Trump and the NRA in light of recent school shootings. They would love to put more guns in our classrooms, in our schools. But that's not the answer. We all know that more guns is not the answer to a gun problem. You know, in our schools, instead of putting guns in our schools, we need to put books in our schools. You know, and that was the cry that you heard last week from parents and teachers and school board members. They want books, not bullets in their schools.
Well, and again, we part of this regional divide that we have in Illinois, as I said, this was largely a move pushed by downstate school board members.
Correct.
They say they have a, you know, a different culture of guns than people up here do, and that their districts are more rural, and that it would take longer for law enforcement to arrive at a school than it would necessarily in an urban or suburban atmosphere.
You know, I heard those arguments, and I still can't get past the, I do believe this is very political and partisan in nature. You know, downstate Illinois is very different than this part of the state. And if you look at the numbers, they support Donald Trump in a very big way. And so when Donald Trump uses his pulpit to say he wants to put guns in our schools, it catches fire in places like downstate Illinois. The NRA is a big contributor to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is a big supporter of theirs. And so I think they're using these school board members in southern Illinois to try to make this issue bubble up. I think they're going to continue to do that. And so we need to stay vigilant and continue to shine a light on it because guns in schools is not the answer. We really need to focus more on things like mental health services if we're going to really be smart about this. We need to focus on wraparound services and giving schools more counselors and not putting more police officers in schools. Things that I think that, you know, if you focus on that now, it's kind of like an investment. If you're investing in it on the front end, it's going to pay off on the back end.
But we've had so many financial struggles in this state. I mean, now, granted, we just approved a historic school state aid funding measure, which includes a commitment of $350 million new each year for schools. The question becomes, you know, there's some people say, well, that's aimed at helping poorer schools, and we can alleviate some of the property tax burden on homeowners that way through this gradual increase. But others want, you know, the additional resources for additional services.
You know, I hear that resource argument all the time. And when I think about putting guns in schools, what that would cost, those schools would have to pay a ton of money in insurance premiums cover the cost of liability of all those folks that could possibly be carrying a gun in their schools. I got to believe that it would be cheaper and more cost efficient to pay for more books in the classrooms or pay for more counselors in the schools than it would be to pay for liability insurance for school personnel to carry a gun. The question is where do you want to place your priorities? Do you want to spend the money on insurance and help big corporations make more money? Or do you want to invest in children and put the money in classrooms?
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. @8:21 on this Sunday morning, I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Democratic State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside. We're talking about the move by the some members, downstate school board members in the Illinois Association of School Boards to try to authorize the use of arming teachers in the classrooms, which was defeated by a narrow vote, but something that has been proposed over the last 3 years. And I guess we should point out, it would still require a change in state law.
It still would require a change in state law. Current state law, the 2013 Illinois carry law, specifically prohibited schools on guns on school property. Also, the federal Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, which was championed by Senator Joe Biden at the time, still prohibits guns in school zones. So understand what this is all about. This is about an organization that is a very powerful lobby in Springfield. If they were able to get the Illinois Association of School Boards the organization behind this, this could pick up some steam to change the law in Illinois. And so what we were trying to do is to cut this off at the head. And I gotta really give a shout out and thanks to Moms Demand Action and the We Will organization and all the folks that came out last weekend in the cold and the snow to speak up about this. Well, and Congressman Quigley joined us.
And you said that I believe that you have a resolution in the House to kind of address this issue as well.
House Resolution 1303 specifically speaks to this issue. It's asking my colleagues in the Illinois General Assembly to join me in stating their loud opposition to putting guns in our schools and arming our teachers. And what we want to do is, send a message to the Illinois Association of School Boards, because I think this issue is going to keep bubbling up. I think that the folks in Southern Illinois are going to keep presenting this issue like they have the last 3 years. And what we want them to know and have their association tell them is this isn't going anywhere.
I want to switch gears just a little bit. I talked to Republican State Representative Tim Butler earlier this morning about we're resuming the veto session this week. And just about the atmosphere in Springfield, a large number of Governor Rauner's vetoes were overridden in one chamber or the other in the first week of the veto session. Now they move to the other chamber. But I just about the atmosphere down there and whether you detect, and I asked Tim, he's a Republican, but whether you detect whether, in essence, Republicans seem more like free agents right now because we do have the fact that Governor Rauner is in lame duck status until J.B. Pritzker takes over on January 14th.
Well, in the first week of veto session, I found the atmosphere to be very positive myself, and I'm looking forward to heading back down this week because I think that we have more work to do. I got to tell you, I think that Governor Pritzker is going to do a remarkable job, and I think the Republicans are going to find themselves enjoying working with J.B. Pritzker. I think if you look at the transition committees that he's been rolling out, they have been bipartisan. He has been not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk, and including a number of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle in on these important committees. And that's because he knows that the way forward is working together. And Tim Butler, Representative Butler from Springfield, is a good friend of mine. He's a diehard Cubs fan like you and I. We've sat in those seats at Wrigley and, we've talked policy. We're going to continue to do that. And that's the only way to do it is to do it with both parties at the table. I think Governor Pritzker is going to lead the way on that.
But do you sense with these veto overrides now at this stage we're at of whether this is kind of a throwing the yoke off by some of the Republicans after the control that Governor Pritzker had?
Absolutely. I think they're very relieved, because what I saw last week was, over 36 bills were overwritten, and those were bills that were sponsored by both Democrats and Republicans, and they were overwritten but in large margins, and people were like, we're free. Let's vote our conscience and do the right thing. When the governor first came in the office, he was intimidating and, for lack of a better term, a bully. I think people are going to actually be able to, feel free and vote their conscience, vote their districts, and not be afraid to reach across the aisle and be seen working with a person of the opposite party.
Let's flash forward to January, and obviously the Democratic majority in the Illinois House has gotten bigger. I believe it's now 74-44.
74-44. I think that's the largest since 1964.
Which would be what happened then, the bedsheet ballot.
Well,
I'll be happy to tell you all about it.
I'm a little bit more optimistic about the things that are going to happen under this supermajority.
Well, but again, I mean, and you've been in a supermajority before, but it just sometimes that also creates free agents as well.
Well, I think it gives people a little bit more freedom to, vote or not vote on some of these issues that may cause them problems in their districts. I think we'll probably see a lot more structured roll calls You know, and that's what we call them in Springfield, where you know people in their districts would have a tough time voting for a specific issue. So you have some freedom to let a couple people, you know, vote present or vote no on tough issues.
But when you do need that super majority, such as in the case of a graduated rate income tax to go on the ballot as a constitutional amendment, you need 71 votes. There isn't a whole lot of leeway there, and that's a difficult issue.
A lot more leeway than we had before.
True. You know,
we had a supermajority on paper.
Right.
We were right at 71, and three or four of those guys were tough to get on a lot of these issues. And so I feel a lot better being at 74 with our chances, and I'm looking forward to taking on a lot of these important issues that we have to address. And I'm hoping the progressive tax is one of the very first things. I know Governor-elect Pritzker and the Speaker have already said that it's something that's important to them. I'm looking forward to voting for it.
Should we know what the rates are before we put a constitutional amendment on the ballot?
Well, I think
if you understand, just, you know, one of the hits at Pritzker was that he wouldn't reveal income rates. Understood where he's coming from there, saying it had to be negotiated with the legislature, but still to put a blind kind of constitutional amendment out there without perhaps knowing the substantive numbers behind it.
We have to understand that was a campaign, that was political rhetoric. And if Governor-elect Pritzker had put a rate out there, people would have criticized him for not working together with everyone. Where did he get these rates from? These are things that the legislative body has to be a part of that process, and that includes all members, Democrats and Republicans. And this is something that the executive branch and the legislative branch would have to negotiate. And I got to imagine that's going to be done with both parties sitting at the table having input on that. But there's a process that has to go forth. First, we have to put this on a ballot, see if this is what the people of the state want. If that passes, then we sit down and negotiate what those rates will be. And let's go through that process. We know we need more revenue. This is a great way to go at it. And I definitely think that this is a state that has several millionaires and billionaires who can pay their fair share in taxes.
That's Democratic State Representative Chris Welch from Hillside. Representative, thanks so much for getting up this morning and joining me here in the Skyline Studio.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoyed the new view.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline Studio is my good friend Michael Golden. He's president of Golden Means Strategies, author of Unlock Congress, man of 9 million different hats, I think. The business card is kind of folds like an old highway map.
It's a revolving production, the business card.
Well, but no one carries business cards.
No, that's right.
Anyway.
It makes
so
it easier.
You can just change it on the fly, right?
Exactly.
Well, I wanted to have you in, Michael, because obviously we're still kind of digesting, I think, the results of the midterms. I mean, we still had seats that were only recently decided. And, heck, we've got a Mississippi Senate
right.
race tomorrow, or on Tuesday. But here you have, as by my count, it's 40 seats that flipped from Republican to Democrat. I don't. That's my best number that I hear.
Yeah, I saw that it was 38 with two left, and the Democrats were leading. It's funny, Paul Lisnick, our colleague at WGN, you know, we were talking about it about 2 weeks before the election, and he asked me, "What's your prediction?" I said, "I don't make predictions anymore after 2 years ago." I said, "If you made me make a guess, I would say 35 to 38." But I think I was sort of being
Did you buy a lottery ticket that day too? I mean, wow.
I was being a little optimistic because setting party aside, I did want to see the president, be taught a lesson and take a shellacking, and he did. But I think a lot of people don't realize how huge a win this is electorally. Forget about what it means for a second. The districts are so gerrymandered since the 2010 census, and you know this was a part of my book, and this is where the rubber meets the road in practicality, right, that the Democrats had to win by at least 6-7 points to even win back control, to even get the 23 seats they needed for control, much less 38 or 40. So, and the turnout was enormous, 111 million people for a midterm election. And that's, you know, that's there was 79 million in the midterm the last time President Obama was in during, the White House. Right. Right. So you think about that, 79 million and 111 million. This was a huge turnout. And the other thing is that the Democrats won by 8.6 percentage points. That's the highest margin, percentage margin, since the midterm following Watergate,
right,
which was just a complete and utter rebuke of the Republican Party because the president had resigned. So this was sort of a historic thing that I think that you know, gets lost in the incredibly fast-paced news cycle and the, you know, the Senate where they gained one or two seats. But it was a pretty full drubbing.
Well, and much like I look at Springfield, I look at this House Democratic majority, incoming majority, that, okay, now you got it. Now what are you going to do with it? And as has been seen historically, Democrats are great at having firing squads in a circle. And part of me, you know, is, you know, can such a diverse group come together? And you know, or is it just going to be all against Donald Trump? And that's forget moving forward with anything.
I think now you may see, and you're already hearing a little bit about it from Washington, some of the more practical things that a lot of Republicans would argue should have been done in the early part of the president's term, like infrastructure, that, you know, the whole country wants that. Now it's going to be tricky for the Senate because they just racked up more debt with the tax relief and all of that, but it's still something the country needs. You and I have talked about this before, that, you know, our waterways are 100 years old, and I mean, you could go run them down the list. Our airports, the country desperately needs this. So that's a way for President Trump to get a win. That's, you know, by, and criminal justice reform, what they did recently, that's not nothing. I think that the Democrats are going to have,
except that it still needs the Senate.
That's true. I think it's going to pass. But
but you have Mitch McConnell, kind of even with Chuck Grassley calling him, saying, you know, you should do this. But McConnell is afraid of certain votes.
Yeah, I think. I'm hoping that they get past it. But I think that the fine line that Democrats are going to have to walk is, first of all, they need to investigate a number of things, from just a constitutional oversight responsibility, and also, obviously, there's some partisanship to it as well. But you can't – very few people, especially in the middle, would make the argument that some of this stuff shouldn't be brought to the light of day, these accusations of corruption and so on and so forth. At the same time, if they just do that for 2 years, it is likely going to hurt them in the presidential race, no matter who is on the ticket. So they have to – it's a fine balance here, and I'm sure polling data will inform a lot of that. But look, you know me. The whole book I wrote was about the Congress working better, really through reforming the rules. But of course, I want the Congress to work better, even if the rules aren't reformed. So I'm rooting for the country to get some things done now that there's some leverage in the House. But this is going to be tricky. Look, under the best of circumstances, when you have divided government, right, in the Congress, in the U.S. Congress, it's very hard to get anything done. You could make the argument that when there's full control, it takes a long time to get something done.
We get a lot of post offices renamed.
Right, exactly.
That tends to be the case.
Isn't that Congressman Gutierrez a specialty? So, but now that there's split control and this sort of, it's a deeply partisan atmosphere. There's just no question. It always has been. The last 30 years, worse and worse and worse. And this president, whether you like him or you don't like him, there's no question that's been exacerbated. So the question is, can these two chambers under different parties get anything done while President Trump is the president? And like I said, he likes to surprise people. And now that he doesn't have full control of the chambers, it would make sense to surprise people by doing some bipartisan things and trying to pull the attention away from the House Oversight Committee, which is just going to subpoena a whole lot of people, and in my view, rightly so.
We're speaking with Michael Golden, president of Golden Mean Strategies, Democratic consultant. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Michael Golden, president of Golden Mean Strategies. We've been talking about the midterm elections, particularly the results in the U.S. House and what that might mean. And we've got a call from Ron. Ron, you're on the Sunday Spin. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Rick. Golden, quick question. The Democratic Party, you know, there's talk of opposition to Nancy Pelosi, and that there were a lot of, you know, newer, younger voters that came out. You know, Bernie Sanders has put together some policy position. Where will the party go? Will it start going to the Senate, or will it be enough influence from the left party to move them somewhat to the left? Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Ron.
So that's a really good question. A lot of people are talking about, will Nancy Pelosi or won't she win the speakership and hold on to power? And we could get into that for a minute. But that's a really good question, because a lot of these Democrats who won, they made statements about not voting for Pelosi, but also they're in districts where they really surprised some Republicans, where Republicans had usually had easy wins. The Democrats played a broad game, I would argue, in the same vein as Rahm Emanuel did back in 2006, and suiting people to the district. But there's a lot of people on the left that are going to be fighting for what they've promised the voters. That's how it works. And by the way, it's really sort of a reflection of what we saw in the presidential primary 3 years ago between Sanders and Clinton. Clinton was, you know, some people call her a liberal Republican compared to Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders, aside from his authenticity and what a character he was, he really stood for far left progressive policies, and he got a ton of support. So I'm not sure. You know, the truth is, I don't know which way it's going to go. I think that the Democrats are going to hang together when it comes to the oversight stuff. They are going to, you know, they're bound in their opposition to this president and a number of things that he's done that really do require at least oversight and investigation. On the policy side, that's why things like infrastructure are going to probably pass here or have a better chance of passing than some of the bread and butter economic issues, where a number of Democrats on the left may buck the party. You know, it's a little different than when Bill Clinton was in office, and, you know, he pulled the party closer to the center because of his charm and presidential power.
Well, but I think we're at the continuation of, I think, the playing out of that presidential campaign, of which side is the Democratic Party? Is it, and you know, as much as Nancy Pelosi can say she's a transformational figure, she has a red light flashing that says establishment on top, okay? And she is a polarizing figure, much in the same way that, you know, that Hillary Clinton was viewed. And so she's an easy target, not only for Republicans, but for more progressive Democrats to point at, much in the same way, I have to say, as Mike Madigan in the speakership of the Illinois House.
That I see where you're going with that. I would not make that analogy, but I get it. I do get
it. Well, but I'm talking about length of tenure of service.
Yes.
Length of service.
Yes.
And also the changing politics of, particularly with electing a great deal of number of women, younger people, and the participation this year, because we can finally, I think, say it after people keep saying it's going to happen, but the greater participation of younger voters in this election.
There's no question. Donald Trump, you know, awakened a sleeping bear in young voters and voters, some low propensity voters who don't vote. You don't get 111 million in a midterm election. That's it's just an astonishing number. And I have to say that because Democrats won governorships and did well in seats also in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. That's a big deal for the I think those same voters will turn out. I think that, you know, in fact, even possibly even more so because it'll be a presidential. But going back to Nancy Pelosi, I think this is really interesting, Rick, the conversation around whether she should or should not be the speaker. This is one of those things where politics is fascinating. Yes, you could make the argument, and I see it, that you should let more young leaders come up. She has had her time. She did a lot, you know, but we're talking about a leadership that are all, I think, in their 70s and 80s, if you took Clyburn and Steny Hoyer. You can make the argument that you need some fresh blood. It's not an ageist thing. It's just that it's a generational thing. However, I have to say, you know, Nancy Pelosi is an incredibly effective speaker. You know, they can make fun of her being from San Francisco, and she could smile and maybe, you know, seem a little, wooden in her interviews. She knows how to crack whips and count votes. And
raise money.
And raise a ton of money. That's where this is interesting. A lot of these Democrats who don't want her in there, she raised a ton of money to get the Democrats back in control. Maybe not in a few of those seats like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio and some of these upsets, but those upsets wouldn't have mattered much if the Democrats didn't win back the majority. So she has a right, and also, you know, Barack Obama and other people, but especially the President Obama, he'll be the first one to tell you, healthcare wouldn't have passed without her. It just wouldn't, and I've heard that from a number of people in D.C. She is the one who held that thing in line, and a lot of folks say, it'd be interesting to hear President Obama answer this question. She's the one who said to him, "Stay strong. We will get this through. But you need to stick with it. You know, this is not going to be easy. But we cannot give up. We'll get the votes."
Well, there was a certain White House chief of staff that was urging the president not to go there.
Exactly, and that just shows you
a certain mayor of Chicago. Now.
Right. We're talking about Rahm Emanuel But that's what I'm talking about with Nancy Pelosi. She's single-minded of purpose when it comes to passing legislation, and she knows, just like LBJ in a way used to, right? He used to know what people needed in the conference. And as soon as he heard it, and he did this as president, right? He'd bang the table and say, "You got it. Now go vote." And I think that's learned over a career. You know, it's not being the minority leader or speaker of the House is a very, very difficult job, even under the best of circumstances.
So very quickly, is she the speaker?
I think so. I think so. I think it'd be very hard to upend that. I think it'll maybe get ugly here. I think it's become more of a challenge than she had anticipated.
I agree. Michael Golden, president of Golden Mean Strategies, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
I love the new digs. It's great to be up here at 303.
I'm glad to have a chance to show them to you.
Thanks, Rick.